Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Jerry Byrne. And today, we are going to play some sort of bingo slash adult beverage game of count the number of current event or pop culture references that we are discussing. Coach Byrne, it is always fun to be joined by you. And today, we are actually going to be talking about recruiting. I'm going to get this started in a very linear way. You strike me as someone who loves recruiting. Am I correct in that?
I don't love everything about it, but I like meeting new people. My wife doesn't think I'm very friendly, but I do like to meet interesting people and you know, kids who are interested in Harvard and their parents who are supporting that pursuit usually have pretty, you know, impressive, interesting, unique pathways to that moment. And, you know, so I'm always looking for that element in recruiting, and I'm passionate about this place, which, you know, the intersection of those two things usually makes for some fun conversations.
I'm glad you answered it that way, because typically when, and, you know, this is largely an Inside Lacrosse conversation, but it does branch beyond like our media platform, that avatar that represents recruiting is just a bunch of, you know, middle-aged guys sitting in lawn chairs on an AstroTurf field and the sun is beating down on them. And the point that you just made is that, you know, the actual practice of recruiting is about a lot more than that. Not to dismiss that that's a part of it, but that it is, in some respects, a small part of it. And I know that that's something that we're going to get to today, is that you've reassessed the extent to which sitting on a hot lacrosse field sideline is a part of the process. When it comes to getting to know a 16, 17-year-old man, how do you like to get started? What are the things that are important to you about kind of setting the tone of the conversation?
You know, I mean, there's different ways to get to that point where you're becoming curious about somebody. It could be, you know, for a lot of us and a lot of the people that you've had on your podcast, is you've been doing it for some period of time. And so your network is full of high school coaches and club coaches and, you know, Sonny Vaccaros of lacrosse. And, you know, I'm 59 years old now, so been around the game for a long time as a player and a coach. And so you have this kind of sea of people that are, you know, they're trying to give you information. And, you know, my approach to it is, I think, very Catholic, in the sense of I'm always worried about one of those emails or texts coming through and recommending some guy. And if I'm in a bad mood or I'm cynical, I'm just delete and, you know, hey, thanks, give him a thumbs up emoji and never contact him again. So, but I do think about missing that guy. That could be the guy who's going to come back and haunt you. And so you have, you know, a variety of people who are trying to get your attention about a player or a group of players. Conversely, on the other side of the, you know, filter is us trying to shake out who has the ability, the interest, affordability, admittability, all the same kind of issues that every coach goes through. So I think it's the kind of yin and yang of that constantly of data coming at you in all these different forms, combined with how good are you and your staff at filtering and doing your diligence, giving them respect of having interest in Harvard, and but at the same time being kind of ruthlessly honest, ruthlessly analytical in who's going to move on to another category, who's going to get deleted, who's going to, you know, get the thumbs down, and how much time do you have to give that feedback back to a player and or a coach.
You became the head coach at Harvard in the summer of 2019, and I remember speaking to you in between when you took the job and when you guys took the field for the first time, and you were really enthusiastic around the talent that was on the roster, the character of the guys that were on the roster, and unfortunately, you only had about 45 days, roughly 40 days to spend with them before the season came to a halt. And then famously, the Ivy League did not participate in the 2021 season. So you resumed activity in 2022 and took the field by storm, making it to the NCAA tournament. And then this season didn't meet that height. So in terms of it feels like we should be having a five-year conversation. But in many respects, I don't think that's true or fair. There's a lot that's wrapped up into that relative to what you were allowed to do for a roughly 20-month window, and then also how you've implemented what you've learned about the proper way to go about doing the job of being the Harvard coach. So without trying to be reductive and without trying to overwhelm you with like a broad question, where do you sit relative to July 2019 in terms of your approach for preparing for recruiting that first class?
You know, listen, you know, if you're not having learned anything in 4 years, then I mean, my head's thicker than most people think it is already. You know, listen, we came in hot that July and that August. We had to basically recruit a whole class for 2020, and then, you know, two weeks later be prepared for you know, the 2021 high school class. So it was pretty, you know, there was no time to breathe. And in some ways, it forced you to be much, you know, less analytical around, all right, all the different kind of sources of data that you can get relative to players. We just didn't have time to do that. We got into prospect days right away, and while at the same time, which I think a lot of, you know, like high school kids right now, is that we're also meeting our team for the first time within the Ivy League rules about how much time you can practice and spend time together, which, you know, as an aside, makes September 1st really kind of a weird thing, because if they're paying attention, one of their questions should be, hey, coach, I know you're in my living room, but aren't your players on campus? Didn't they just show up? Or shouldn't you be coaching them or, you know, mentoring them and things like that? So there's a little bit of a try to avoid the hypocrisy of that. We're all trying to look forward, but we can't look so far forward without kind of looking at what we had. So that conundrum is always going on, I think, hopefully in any coach's mind. Who is here and what do you have? And what are you doing to build and develop that versus, oh my God, this, you know, 16-year-old who does this, this, and this, I think I'm in love. And so, you know, you can only make dinner with what you have in the cupboard, which I think we did really well that first spring, our staff. I think we did a really good job of, you know, getting to know the guys who were here that we inherited. We invited a bunch of walk-ons. We had like an open tryout for anybody who had played lacrosse at Harvard. We ended up, you know, keeping six or seven walk-ons on the team, and many of them are still around. And, you know, so that was kind of like a Oklahoma land rush of, we just got to go, man. We got to get in the covered wagon and go. And, you know, as far as 4 years later, you know, most of my staff is still together. We had a couple of guys, you know, move on to other jobs this summer, which I'm super excited and well-deserved for them, is, you know, you have obviously a deep understanding of Harvard and Harvard's processes. And you even though it's been disjointed with everything that's going on, you feel like you know the guys that you have, you know the guys that you inherited, and you are, you know, you understand the landscape of who you're competing against and what their messages are. I didn't, you know, in my previous life, I didn't recruit that aggressively against the Ivy League. And now I'm trying to recruit against, you know, all the teams in the ACC. And so I was able to bring some of that knowledge to this and maybe attack it in a different way.
So understanding that you did well, and first of all, we're going to call the Oklahoma land rush as reference number one. I should have included historical references underneath the umbrella of modern mainstream political or otherwise, plus popular culture really kind of intersected around that 1982 to 1989 window, I think, is roughly the wheelhouse. Is that right?
Well, that's when I was graduating from high school, so yeah.
It's frozen in time. The you brought something up that I want to revisit, and it's the notion of, well, I want to kind of attack this in two ways. So on the one hand, we spoke a couple weeks ago about how your summer went, and you made the comment that you felt like you were fighting your own urge to essentially log hours on the sideline and be less unintentional with your time and more pointed, and you know, kind of that being a little bit of a juxtaposition or evolution from where you had previously been, which was, you know, very much valuing first guy there, last guy out type mentality. And so that's one aspect, because you and I have sat next to each other on a bunch of sidelines, and I think, you know, we've talked about what we're watching players do and whether or not that feels like the type of player that you would want to coach 3 years down the road. But the other thing that I want to address is what you brought up around prospect days, because the other thing that, you know, I've gleaned from our conversations over the last 10 or 15 years is how much you value a combination of guys competing against each other, being able to control the environment, or being able to find environments where whoever is in control of them is creating competitive stakes. Because you want to see that juice, you want to see that flair, you want to see that energy, that anger, that passion, whatever it is that's going to differentiate the run-of-a-mill performance versus the type of performance that you think is going to matter in a real Harvard lacrosse game. And then the last element is the opportunity to coach them yourself. And prospect days offer a lot of those opportunities. So again, a meandering question, but I do think that there's a lot of meat on the bone. Let's start with what you're looking for when you're sitting on sidelines and how you regard a player that plays with passion, energy, anger, fierceness, whatever the term that you use actually is.
No, I think you started earlier in the question, which was kind of an intentionality around what am I going to? Why am I going to this event? Who am I going to see? What matchups am I looking for? You know, either team versus team, or, you know, a defenseman versus an attackman. And do I have an expiration date for my day? Do I force that? Like, hey, I'm, you know, Neil Hutchinson, my head assistant, does an unbelievable job in recruiting. You know, we had a couple of trips this year where we left on the 6 a.m. flight from Logan, flew to Baltimore, you know, Ubered to a field, and then forced ourselves to be on the 8 o'clock flight. And so something about, you know, time boxing that day, now we have to step back and say, okay, you're going to see this team twice. You really like that guy. You're going to see him, you know, three times. You like this matchup. And so Neil was kind of like my concierge around building my day so that I could be, you know, super kind of militant about it. And versus in the past, and again, I love recruiting. You started doing that, but there was something about cordoning off my day that I felt like made me do my job better this summer. And it would be unbelievable if, you know, parents and club guys did the exact same things. Like, I don't need to see a guy play five times. And do I, you know, if on the fifth game the guy doesn't celebrate with his, or his mom's carrying his bag, or he doesn't run sub off the midfield line, I don't judge him too harshly, because when I'm playing pickleball, sometimes I don't get to every shot. You know, so I know what I do when I'm tired. So, and I consider myself somewhat athletic. So I'm just trying to see them at their best. And, you know, and that, you know, there's a challenge in that too, because you're walking from field to field at one of, you know, Blandair Park. And as we were alluding to earlier, you know, a lot of people, and people want to stop and talk to you. I feel like, you know, feel like the guy in Airplane when he's walking into the airport and he starts punching Hare Krishnas and people asking him for money. I'm just like, I'm trying to get the field too. I'm supposed to be at Orchard Mills, which is like a 20-minute walk for a guy my age. And I'm like, just just, hey, how you doing? And so, you know, so I think time boxing really kind of just forcing myself into a window, while at the same time doing that also had a motivation for my young assistants so they could be home with their young families and so they could stay fresh, because it was less about, you know what, I got to be at every game. And so, like,
I want a big part of this podcast is meant to provide advice, usually to parents, but sometimes to high school or club coaches. So your Airplane reference was number two. I'm going to use an Aaron Sorkin reference as number three. Word of advice to every high school and club coach that wants to talk to Jerry Byrne: ask him where he's going and do the walk and talk, the Aaron Sorkin walk and talk from West Wing and everything else that he's ever written.
Right. So, you know, so I think that was really helpful. I think it was healthy, and I think it was helpful. And it allows you to kind of build up a database of, 200 people that you really liked in the summer along a scale. And so that when you're building out your prospect day, and, a portion of your prospect day people are going to be, I want to go to play Harvard lacrosse. I don't know whether they feel the same way, but I'm going to find my way to get there. And, another percentage is, club coach is telling us, Johnny's really interested, all right, we send the information, so it's open to everybody. But I think most of the really good teams, I think, have done a good job of just like, hey, this event is for good lacrosse players who have some academic credentials, who are really interested in Harvard. And so you have kind of a universe of people that you want to see play. And then they if we're doing our homework on questionnaires and collecting academic information, you're knowing whether someone is a good match even before they get there. And then you get to coach them one-on-one. You have, 80 to 100 players at an event, and you have your whole staff out there. So you got four or five coaches out there, so the ratio is good. Maybe you have your players who are taking summer school, and you can really get, if you do it well, you can really get a pull behind the curtain of, here's how we coach, here's a peek into our culture, because our guys are going to be coaching some of the games. You can ask them questions. They're going to be super engaged because we challenge our guys, because they're like the front porch to our program. As much as I think that's me, it's not. It's the other 18, 19, 20-year-olds who a couple of years before, they were in that huddle, right? I mean, nearly every guy that we've recruited has come to our prospect day in 4 years. And so it's not a requirement by any stretch, but it just happens to work out that way. They expressed interest, came to our event. We were excited that they came. We liked the way they played, and it was a match made in heaven. So I think the most critical thing is less about, and I can come back to that question around, do I like the way that they play? And yeah, that's probably part of the reason why some of them are there. But I think the more critical thing is that they get to leave, and whether we recruit them or not, that they feel like they know us, they know our players, and whether they come or not, at worst we made a fan and someone who's wishing us well in our kind of endeavor to become a top 10 program. And if we do recruit them, they learned everything. They learned about the city, they learned about Cambridge, they learned about the geography and the architecture of Harvard, they learned the personality of our guys. All of that stuff, super valuable.
One thing that I know is really important is you want to pay attention to details such that you can create a quality experience. One anecdote that you shared is, if you want to get food delivered, it's difficult to navigate Harvard Square at times. And so you have to be specific in the address that you put in order to actually get the delivery. How do you describe your approach to that type, that level of conscientiousness in communication?
I think how I started recruiting changed when my children went through it. you see events, you see travel, you know, having my kids travel with me, which is how they got recruited, is that I would be going to an event and I would call, you know, Mike Chen and Chuck or Ryan McLaren or John Zissi and be, hey, you know, or, you know, I'd call Mike Farrell for my daughter or something. So they traveled with me and I was kind of at these events as a professional coach, but I was also there as a parent. And, you know, which is true in the regular world and our discourse and all the drama that's taking place in our everyday lives. A lot of it is driven by there's not a civil discourse around the things that people can disagree on. And the other part of that is if you can't put yourself in someone else's shoes, how can you ever feel that you can understand their pain, their struggle, their hopes, the things that frustrate them or not? And so having my kids attend events, some were good, some were bad, some had good coaching, some had bad coaching, some rosters were right, some were wrong, the parking was terrible, sometimes it was great, some had food, some didn't. Like going through that it completely, not that I didn't consider myself empathetic to parenting or parenting aspiring athletes. I think going through that just, it changed. And so one of the ways that it changed, I believe, is that when, whether it was an event at Notre Dame that I was driving or at Harvard, is that I wear the hat of the aspiring athlete and I wear the hat of the parent. And what I also believe is that if I can pull all the anxiety that goes into it, which is, you know, I get into arguments with young assistants on the sideline all the time who are complaining about parents of this generation or their kids are soft, something like that. My first question is, tell me how many kids you have. And it's usually this. And so my next thing is some version of STFU. And but having gone through that, I'm trying to pull all that anxiety out. Because if the kid, you know, and again, my parents, we were late to stuff all the time. You don't run out of the car for your football game like this when you're worried about whether you left a sock or a cleat and it's been a scramble to get into the car. So we're trying to make everything as simple and organized as possible. The kid's going to be less stressed, which allows him to shine. The parents can watch, they can eat, they can travel. We give a walking tour. We don't give a walk tour. You're not allowed to, but you're, you know, a self-guided walking tour. Like now, if their son plays well or not, at least it was an enjoyable visit for the two of them. Maybe it's a great memory of a great weekend. And obviously it's even better if they get recruited, but I just try to wear that hat. I try to put myself, I've been there. I've been on those sidelines as a parent. I know how bound up they are. I know how nervous recruiting and events and a coach was on his phone. Like I've gotten texts, or excuse me, emails. Hey, so-and-so coach reached out. They said you were on your phone when Johnny, you know, ripped that one from 15 on the run. And that actually happens. And so that's the level of detail that they're watching you. So if they're watching me in our program, we want to try to do everything at a really high level.
So one of the things that you mentioned earlier is that you've got, you know, let's say 200 names in a class. Harvard is a world-class institution. Not many places can you play college across and graduate with a degree and into an alumni network that would come close to approaching Harvard, much less supersede it. And yet, not every player who you think Harvard would or should be a fit for thinks he himself is or would be a fit for. And a lot of it has to do with some preconceptions around the institution. And that's been something that you've tried to attack or address. What's that been like? How did you first encounter that? How did it hit you when somebody said something to the effect of like, I don't think Harvard's for me? And how have you gone about trying to at least put folks in the position where they can be better informed before they make the decision as to whether or not Harvard's for them?
You know, I think I came with that mindset. Not that, like, I didn't know anybody growing up who went to Harvard. And so, and again, all your perceptions, which may be wrong or misguided, are totally fueled by movies and media tropes and memes and, you know, and a lot, some of them could be quite funny and some may not always be inaccurate, but in the lowest common denominator, people, you know, with the things that they don't know, they tend to, or don't understand, they tend to fear and then malign. And I think Harvard had fallen into it, even though Harvard works really hard at not telling its own story. You know, like I tell people that Harvard could discover another planet and it would be like the fifth bullet point in the employee, you know, monthly newsletter. Like the last thing they want is like attention. It's quite funny and humorous, but I came in with a belief, even though it wasn't predicated on any experience that I ever had. I just made a guess based on, you know, second and third hand things that you'd heard from
the movie, The Social Network,
from people, but more about lacrosse program relative to what people thought about it. And so I went in with that, my own perception. And, you know, we had, as we were educating ourselves on its history, its art, its architecture, its alumni, its journey since, you know, it's 140 years older than the Declaration of Independence, for God's sake. And so it predates our country. It's older than our country by 140 years. And so learning about that, and I happen to be a history buff, I think was super important for us understanding how we were going to tell the story of Harvard. But what you also have to do, it's not always a one-to-one. I don't always get to talk to a recruit on Zoom or, you know, on the phone or face-to-face. So all of those people that you connect with over, you know, 20 years of doing this, they become really important storytellers for you. And you know, giving them the ammunition to tell your story is really critical. And so we worked really hard at that. We worked really hard at using, you know, our network of emails and social and things like that, because I couldn't rely on Inside Lacrosse just to tell my story. You were telling, you know, 400 stories with all the different programs and all the lacrosse stories, and we may never raise to the level of a worthwhile story from Inside Lacrosse. So we had to tell our own story. And I think myself and Ted Bergman, who was my former assistant, you know, Ted did an unbelievable job of, you know, executing that vision. And we still do it to this day, because I don't want someone, I want someone to have, understand the value, the character, the attributes, what the experience is going to be like. And I'm going to use every vehicle I can to tell that. And it was, and you'll learn something new every day. And whenever we learn something new, we try to incorporate it.
How does your team, how does your current team fit into that story? And how will that continue to evolve as time moves forward?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, so telling the story of Harvard lacrosse includes a combination of telling the story of Harvard, telling the story of the program. But there's also, you know, the 40 guys, there are 45 guys that are currently on the team. What you mentioned that they are the front porch when players come to prospect days and have an opportunity to be coached by and interact with them. How do those guys represent not the storytellers, but a part of the story?
You know, I think that, you know, the guys who came here, we were very transparent where we were. When we got to that first September 1st, when we'd been here for 5 weeks, you know, we told them we didn't know very much. We hadn't even coached the team that we inherited yet. You know, you can make assumptions about what you saw in film and things like that, but we didn't. I think there was one or two players on the team I had recruited at Notre Dame. And so, you know, what we told them there is that, you know, you got to want to build. You got to be a bit adventurous. You got to be a bit revolutionary. You got to be able to say, I know that program's not where it's going to be, but I want to be part of where it's going to go. And that there was an element of independence that's still true today, because yes, we've had some success and we've had some really good, you know, wins over ranked teams, but we haven't found that consistency yet. And that's probably a combination of coaching mistakes and youth and us learning more and more about how you navigate Harvard. But that independence and that kind of revolutionary experience was really critical to us. That because that guy and those parents would need to explain that to the other players on their club team or their high school coaches or club coaches. Why are you saying no to this fully formed team from the ACC or in our league? Why are you going to go to the, you know, because they, you know, I know it's going to be a beautiful house up on the hill. Right now it still needs some paint and some roofing, but, you know, the landscaping's coming together nicely, and it's, you know, so those guys, you know, how did they articulate it? They embodied it, because all those players said no to programs that were further down the road. And we also used, you know, Harvard is one of the first teams to play lacrosse. They've been playing lacrosse at Harvard for almost 150 years now. The first kind of championship that they ever held, Harvard won in 1881. So we use that as in part of our own storytelling, that even though it's not, you know, a history like some other teams, there's been some really critical moments from great players, Ivy League championships, Ivy League players of the year, but, you know, just up and down, that including our time here, that we're trying to kind of make a 45 degree angle up into the right kind of journey. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
no, you did. You did. I think one of the reasons, and I didn't want to be as direct in the way that I asked it, but one of the reasons that I wanted to hear that was because, again, going back to the conversations that we had shortly after you took the job, I mean, you were pretty intentional in how much time you wanted to spend getting to know your athletes or your players or your team in ways other than just in the weight room or just on the field. You know, I don't think that a lot of your peers would have approached the same way. And what that said to me then and now is, you know, an acute understanding for the role that being a team, being a collective, being a group of folks that are working collectively and in, you know, as close to as of one mind as possible toward a common goal, how important that was. And so, you know, to the extent that so much of this conversation falls down to, you know, what you just said in terms of having advocacy in order to allow folks who you want to be a part of their program give themselves permission to want to be a part of your program in whichever direction it might be. You obviously addressed the prospect of, you know, foregoing an opportunity at a quote unquote fully formed ACC program in order to, you know, build a house on a hill. Whereas, like, there's the other side of the coin, which is kind of the way that I framed the question two ago, which was around the notion of, you know, isn't Harvard for all those Exeter and Andover kids that I have no relationship with understanding what their life and lifestyle is. And, you know, that kind of duality of realizing it's like, no, this is like, if you know how to build winning lacrosse teams. And I, you know, would assume that there's a gap between your understanding of what broadly and generally wins versus what specifically is needed in order to win at Harvard, right? And that's where time comes in, and that's where familiarity comes in, and everything else that we talked about relative to the way in which this kind of uneven path dating back to July 2019 actually unfolds. All that being said, it's a really nice opportunity to segue into talking about 2025. So
can I jump in there for a second? Because I feel absolutely. Like... I think one of the ways that we've had success in getting to know our players is that their aspirations for after Harvard, this is, you know, it's a competitive world out there. It's, you know, it's becoming more technological. You know, certain skills are under real threat. You know, what are you going to learn? What are presumptions that people are going to make about you and Harvard, and your own ability to tell your own story is so critical. So we spend a lot of time. I have one-on-one meetings in my office, which is where I am right now, and I learn about where they want to go and how our 1,200 living alums can help them. I spend probably about 20% of my time working on what my guys are going to do when they leave here. I think much like coming back to the prospect day where knowing how to where to deliver the food at Harvard can be a stressful thing if you order Uber, is the same thing. Is there's a lot of stress of how am I going to compete with all these really brilliant people in my classroom where I needed my athletic ability to help me to get into Harvard. Is so I work hard on their internships and their externships and their interview prep and their, you know, the companies and, you know, our database and all the different tools that we use, because I don't want them to worry about it. Not because I'm trying to snowplow their life. There's no college coach in the country that can guarantee you a job. I mean, that's not 100%, like, unless you have somebody, because there's too many HR rules and things like that. But we can help you get into the Elite Eight. And now you have to beat seven people out for that job. If you can't do that, then you've got bigger problems than I can help you with. So I'm not trying to snowplow and soften their life. Being an athlete at Harvard, you're failing a lot. It's kind of why our guys are so successful. They kill it in the classroom. Two straight years we've led the country in GPA. And that's no joke. That's not easy to do at this place. And so, you know, I'm trying to help them to take some of that anxiety away from at a place that's really challenging. And as far as how we're helping them in other ways tell their story, it's just, simply put, if you don't have gratitude and just an appreciation for being here, you can't be a great teammate. You can never be a great player. And you'll leave here and have missed it all. And so we start with that, because I think if you have that, you can study what you want. You'll love it. You're not thinking about it as, oh, I need to go to some business school or I need to develop some specific skill. You're going to be trained to think and write and debate and analyze at Harvard. And that's a valuable skill combined with the grit that you're going to develop being a Division I athlete. That, I feel like that is our algorithm for success here.
So I started to segue into talking about recruiting the class of 2025 and bringing all of the observation that you guys and your staff have conducted over the course of the last 2 months, really June and July and preceding that, to fruition and starting to get to know folks and figure out whether or not it is a good benefit, a good two-way street. We're recording this before September 1st, and it'll post shortly after. What is your staff's strategy to that moment or for that moment of first contact?
You know, I think part of it is, you know, what's your swing plane? You know, who is not interested? Who is, you know, expecting big scholarship? Who wants to go to a, you know, the preeminent academic schools, or who wants to go to a good academic school that has big time, you know, wants to go to a big time football game, you know? So there's, you know, the strategy is, and I think it's similar to a lot of schools, is that you do your homework. You have kind of conversations around what do they want? You know, this, you know, I was talking to a club coach in my drive this morning, and the last thing I ever want someone to do on my behalf, whether either out of respect for Harvard or appreciation for Harvard, or they like me, or they think I'm someone worthy of respect or does a good job, whatever that reasoning is, the last thing I want someone to do is be like headlocking one of their guys saying, are you like a moron? Harvard's interested and they're not in your top three. And I don't want some high school and club coach to browbeat some guy into interest. When has that ever worked? You know, so we trust some of the feedback and research that we're allowed to do by NCAA rules and evaluating transcripts and looking at questionnaire responses. All of that stuff gives you data points. Now, what I think that you have to realize is that an answer at the end of July might be different than the answer at the end of August. And it might be different on September 3rd when Johnny loved XYZ school, but they didn't love him. They like him. Meanwhile, we love little Johnny, but he didn't have us in that group. So it makes the the juggling of the Jenga of when are you pulling out a piece and saying, hey, this is my guys. There are some guys that you come into September 1st and it's like, yeah, all of those guys are our guys. How many of those, you know, can afford it, can be admitted, you know, don't want to go to some of these other schools? And so some of it you need to be trust and verify what you think you learned and what you know. And but I'm always surprised every year by when we reach out to some kids. Some of them might be a reach and they end up coming to Harvard. And you're like, all the signs before that were pointing, hey, you're fifth out of five. And they're top five, you know. And so
yeah.
So you bring a hopefulness to it, but you also bring a cynicism. You know, I think that's my kind of mojo anyway. I'm much more
hopeful, cynic.
Hopeful and positive of stuff, but I'm also, I need to believe it. I'll believe it when I see it type mindset. You know, same thing with, you know, you can't get somebody's transcript and you're like, that's usually not a very good sign. And meanwhile, you expect these high school and club coaches to be like, you know, that's kind of part of what you're supposed to be helping us with. And so what we're doing is, I tell Neil and Nick Grill, who's our new assistant, and Mike Terranova and Christian Thomas, our new staff, is like, prove to me that this guy's interested, or prove to me that that guy's going to be, you know, be able to test or have, you know, grades to get in here. You know, prove it to me, because we're all falling in love with a guy that maybe we, you know, when it comes down to it, may not be worthy of that love. And so most of what we're doing right now is peeling back the onion level by level, peeling the banana, trying to find out what is it, and is that, we know we like their skill, but are all the other pieces kind of be things that we can, you know, that either confirm it or dispel it.
We're getting toward the end of this conversation and we've covered a lot of ground. One thing that came up that we didn't really get into because the question that I asked was too long is about how you value a certain edge that an athlete plays with and competes with. And I don't want to go all the way back to the, you know, when we were talking about evaluation and, you know, maybe there's some more meat on that bone. But with that being said, what is, when you think back on some of the most competitive MFers that ever played for you, what was it like when you got to know them personally and individually? Is there a personality trait that kind of is common and shared, or is it all over the place relative to, you know, what that athlete looks like when the whistle has not yet blown?
I don't know if there's a thing. I, you know, 20 years of doing this, I don't think I've gotten any better at it. I don't think I've garnered any sort of like special insights or wisdom of kind of like I'm looking for, you know, like in a movie where, excuse me, there's some moment that, you know, the sky opens up, you know, and you know, everything becomes clear. I think I've become more harder to make decisions than easier. You would think over time that a volume of a certain hundreds of games and things like that, that it would become easier. I think anyone who tells you that they have some Rosetta Stone that sparks some sort of clarity, you know, I think if you're lucky, every couple of years, a guy just leaps off the page. I mean, I think about like the difference between like John Sexton and Matt Landis. Both won the Schmeiser. You know, Matt was a freakazoid athlete who, you know, didn't have a great stick and, you know, had trouble picking up the ball. But I can see the moment I saw him play for the first time. I know exactly where I was. I know exactly what the event was. A friend of mine.
Where were you?
I was at when the Empire State Games had came back after a year where they canceled it.
Yeah.
I was at Canisius. I can see it. It was at Canisius's baseball sport field. So the part of the field kind of bled into the AstroTurf outfield. And a buddy of mine, was, you know, Tim Scher, is the head coach at, one of my great friends, the head coach at Yorktown High School, told me to check this guy out. Like, I was stunned. And he was an alternate. Nobody wanted him on the team at all. He wasn't even selected. Someone else got sick or couldn't make it. And then I think about John Sexton, who I just saw this weekend at a wedding. His high school coach was a friend, Brian Vona from Lincoln Sudbury High School. And his older sister was going to be a player at Notre Dame. And he came out and visited when he was like a ninth grader. He already started on their team as an eighth grader. He subsequently became, I think, maybe the only three-time high school All-American in Massachusetts history. But when he came and visited, he was like 5'5", 130. But when Brian Vona was telling me about him, because his sister was coming out for her official visit, he's like, he's coming, you should meet him. The guy's an absolute animal. He's going to be one of the great players in Massachusetts history. So I think some guy who's shaving already is going to show up in a 5'5", 125, 130-pound guy shows up. And I remember we were walking on the field because we took our recruits onto the field back then. I called Brian Vaughn, and I'm like, are you effing me? Are you like this guy? He's like, trust me, Italian. You know, and I did trust him, you know. And I saw him play very little, you know. He just, you know, two different kinds of athletes, guys who, one guy who was just, you know, shot out of a cannon athletically, who just moved like people are, like animals are supposed to move. And then Sexton, who was a good athlete, but just had a spatial, like, hockey players like Wayne Gretzky, I don't go where the puck is. I know where it's going to go. John had an unbelievable knack of timing guys' sticks for checks and picking up balls that you'd have to slow down the tape to figure out how with his traditional stick. So it's like love, you know, you kind of know it when you see it. You know, you're just in love. There's probably a chemical and a biology around it, but you're just in love. And same thing with watching a player play. It's probably a convergence of all the things that you like and the things that you don't like and how you're feeling in the moment and stuff like that. And I think, lastly, I think players becoming really good reflects a coach's belief, future belief of who they can become. It affects how you coach them, how you inspire them, how you challenge them. And so, yes, some of it's biology, your parents athletic, or you work really hard at it. I tell guys all the time, yeah, do the ladder work and stuff. I'm not sure how much that's going to change your footwork, right? But, you know, biology, inspiration, spatial awareness, passion for competitiveness, you know, teamwork and people who learn moment to moment in a game. I think all that stuff. But I think a coach, educator, his belief and his vision of when he saw you and what you could become, whether you saw him as a, you know, going to be a great player and doesn't become a great player, but you believe there's a great man inside of there, I think that is as much, that importance is as much as X's and O's.
Jerry Byrne, what are you reading?
What am I reading? I am reading Bono, the lead singer of U2's, I would say it's a biography. It's called Surrender. He picked 40 songs from their catalog, of U2's catalog, and kind of tells a little bit about the making of the story, but also the moment in time in the band and in his life and their relationships. I find it really inspiring. He's a really good writer. He's a self-aware person, but he's also very generous and with his head and his heart, and I find it really interesting. I'm also reading Michael Lewis's book about the COVID thing. It's the title's escaping me. I keep on leaving it and coming back to it. Not the turning point or something like that. I can't remember.
What are you listening to? Have you found yourself down a particular Spotify or Apple Music rabbit hole recently?
I was not a podcaster. I think you're one of the people who's recommended different podcasts to me. I listened to Scott Galloway, who is a professor of marketing at NYU and a, you know, an interesting investor, an interesting observer of our culture, the intersection of our culture and media and finance and kind of where the world is and where it's going. So I've become quite a kind of voracious listener of him. You know, Robbie Robertson, the lead, one of the guitarists from the band, passing away, you know, affected me because I love that movie and I love the group. And so that was like a moment to go back and watch The Last Waltz again, and then his documentary called Once We're Brothers, which is kind of a little bit of a rebuttal or a part two to The Last Waltz, telling the story of the band. And so I'm listening to a lot. I listen to a lot of kind of, you know, roots music and singer-songwriters, but I also, you know, listen to a lot of J. Cole and Drake, and I like, you know, I like my hip-hop too.
50th anniversary. Yes. And you mentioned you recently rewatched The Last Waltz. I watched a little bit of Roadhouse last night. What was the most recent movie you saw for the first time?
Most recent movie I saw.
Did you see Oppenheimer?
I did not see Oppenheimer or Barbie.
Neither have I.
Yet, you know, I watch a lot of like documentaries. I love true crime. I love, you know, I love like the diligent, you know, having a father who was a policeman and a civil servant, became a fireman, is I have a lot of respect, you know, the good and bad of that profession, but also the kind of the dogged diligence that detectives take to, you know, solve, you know, a dead, you know, cold case file. I just, you know, the it gets them closure, it gets the families closure. So if that pops up on my Netflix, you know, feed, I watched one about the a serial killer out in California called I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which, you know, was basically about
it's a creepy title.
Online sleuths and how they tracked down a guy like 40 years later. And that felt good when they finally got that guy.
There you go.
I have a little revenge. Great. I look for players who have some revenge in their hearts too.
There you go. Love it. Great note to end on. Really appreciate your time on the Inside the Cross podcast. Best of luck as you continue to find the gems of the 2025 class and build out your future teams, and look forward to getting eyes on you hopefully this fall and certainly next spring.
Thank you, Terry.
Inside the Cross Podcasts, the source of the sport.